From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
Our guest this morning is Michael Horkachuk, who manages the NASA SpaceX Commercial Crew Program, the next astronaut mission dubbed Crew One and scheduled for October 23rd, marks the first of regular rotational missions to the International Space Station by the SpaceX Crew Dragon. Four astronauts will launch atop a Falcon 9 rocket. We're so pleased that Michael could join us again on Cool Science Radio. Welcome, Michael Horkachuk.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. Well, all this technology this morning, getting JW to join us from Boston. It's not as much technology, however, as our recent space missions. Incredible. We were witnessing earlier this year the exciting launch when the two astronauts launched to go to the International Space Station. A sudden flurry of space travel. Tell us a little bit about this mission coming up in October.
Okay. The Crew One mission will be the first operational mission of the SpaceX vehicles. So the last mission that launched Doug and Bob was a demonstration mission, a test flight, basically. We did an unmanned test flight, and then we did previous to that, they did a pad abort test, and then they did an in-flight abort test to check out the functionality of the abort system throughout the entire range of the flight spectrum. And now we're going into the operational phase. So we've had the vehicle designed so that it can carry four astronauts to the space station and do regular transfer operations so that we can constantly rotate the crews up on board the space station. So right behind it will be a Crew 2 mission about 6 months later. The typical time that the astronauts are up on the space station these days is about 6 months. So no sooner will we have gotten Crew 1 launched than we're pushing to get the Crew 2 vehicle ready to go.
Well, that's exciting. So you say about 6 months for astronauts to be at the International Space Station. I'm forgetting, is that sort of the record time, or wasn't it quite a bit longer that we or another country had astronauts on the International Space Station?
Yeah, I think the record is more on the order of about a year. That's a really long duration mission. In fact, NASA had two twins that were both astronauts. One of them was launched on one of those really long duration missions, and they were comparing the effects that he experienced compared to his brother that stayed here on Earth.
Right. That was Scott Kelly, right?
Correct.
And Michael, welcome back to Cool Science Radio. And I wanted to ask you, now that you've had a chance to analyze a lot of the data, and I know you're still looking at data, what have you learned about the Dragon capsule from the Crew One mission that you find significant?
Okay, so we've just recently done the post-flight review on the Demo 2 mission. What I noticed while I was on console was there were very few alarms that went off, which means the vehicle was performing really, really well, both on the launch up to the space station and on the return to the ground. It was a really, really smooth mission overall.
Yes.
There were a few things that we've learned as we're starting to disassemble the spacecraft, and we're rolling that into design changes or minor corrections on the Crew One vehicle. But overall, it was a nearly flawless mission.
And I should know the answer to this, but I really don't. Do we have the capability right now to have fully autonomous docking with unmanned payloads?
Yes.
In other words,
the Dragon spacecraft,
we don't have astronauts,
designed...
we've got a big payload, and we somehow autonomously get that to the International Space Station without human intervention.
We will soon. So
okay.
There are two different things that can happen on the space station. The original COTS program and the Dragon 1 vehicle was designed to go up to the space station and berth with the space station to a berthing port. It's sort of the big attachment mechanism that was used to attach the modules together. So what the vehicle would do is it would fly up to the space station, get really close to the space station, and then just hover there. And then an astronaut would grab it with the robot, the Canadian robot arm, and pull it in to berth with the berthing port on one of the nodes. So that's not fully autonomous, but it was an unmanned vehicle. So it was autonomous all the way up to the point that it was hovering for the astronauts to grab it. Now, with manned vehicles, we have what we call a docking system where there's no robot arm involved at all. The vehicle flies up and slowly inches its way forward, attaches to a soft capture ring, and then once it's attached there, it gets sucked in, basically, and then the hard capture latches attach. So that's called docking as opposed to berthing. So there's no robot arm involved in that. And that's what the new Dragon 2 crew vehicles will do. And then I know SpaceX is working on a vehicle, a cargo version of this vehicle that would do the same thing, going to a docking system.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Michael Horkachuk. He manages NASA's on-site government representative's office at SpaceX for NASA's $2.6 billion commercial crew program contract. And, you know, contrary to what you've just been talking about, unmanned craft, this one, as you already mentioned, consists of a team of four astronauts. So going to be kind of crowded there on that craft. And it's interesting to me that you've got, in this team of four, you have an international partner from Japan, you have a woman, you have a rookie, and you have a veteran. Can you tell us a little bit more about the crew?
Oh, yeah. It looks like it's a great crew. I've known Mike Hopkins and Victor Glover for a while. They've been assigned to the mission for quite a while, so they've been coming out to SpaceX on a regular basis, and they, you know, in between their training and testing, they'd come by and ask to look at some of the videos I had of some of the parachute tests, where we were making sure that the parachute system was certified for all the flight environments. Both of them are really good guys, and I don't know Shannon and Sayuchi, I think is how you say it, mm-hmm. as much. They were assigned a little bit later in the mission flow.
Yeah, well, I'll give a go at pronunciation. Soichi Noguchi from Japan. How often is it, I mean, I don't think it's often at all that we actually partner and have other astronauts from varying countries on our craft.
Well, we have a number of international partners in the space station program. JAXA, Japan, is one of them. There's also European Space Agency, so that whole group of European countries. Italy provided a number of elements of the space station separately from ESA. And as part of each one of those agreements, as they contributed parts of the space station, they also got access to having astronauts fly to the space station. So I'm not sure exactly what the percentage and flight rate is for each one of the different countries, but we're supposed to be flying astronauts from those different partner countries on a regular basis. And obviously the Russians and the United States are the bigger partners. And Canada is also a partner that provided that robot arm that I mentioned earlier.
Right.
Michael, we are getting close to the 20-year anniversary of the International Space Station being in orbit. It's hard to believe it's been 20 years, but we've had so many people up there, so many missions. And this might be an unfair question to you because you're responsible for the NASA SpaceX commercial crew program. But what do you think are some of the takeaways from what the International Space Station has taught us?
Good question. One is how to work with all these different international partners across not just continents, but across the different cultural differences between each one of those different countries. And how to build what is probably the most complex vehicle, if not pieces of structure that the world has ever put together, and have it all fit together in space and work together. So beyond just learning how to live and work in space, I think it's bridged the gap between different countries and shown us how to work together as a unified team.
Yeah, exactly. And you were mentioning earlier that the mission, you know, not too long ago, this spring, for Crew One, that you're now disassembling that Dragon capsule so that you can make engineering changes for future capsules. And the International Space Station's been in orbit for 20 years, and we've made some changes to it. But I'm wondering what significant design changes we would make if we were to build the International Space Station today, to make certain areas larger, to expand the cargo bay. I mean, I really don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that? Again, another unfair question.
Yeah, I used to work on the space station program. I used to manage the integration of all the payloads to the International Space Station, but that was a long time ago. Back during the first Element launches. On the Demo 2 mission, Bob Behnken did 4 EVAs with the station crew to change out batteries on the space station. So the battery systems have been upgraded with newer technology and, constant charge and discharge cycles over all those years. The older batteries were in need of an upgrade.
Right.
I think the life support system we've been learning a lot about, and the different technologies and what works and what doesn't work, which is going to be very important if we expect to go to the moon and stay on the moon and then go to Mars. And volume has always been a challenge, I think, on the space station, just having enough room for all the supplies and science experiments. In fact, at one point we worked with a company to where we licensed out an inflatable module technology and attached that to the space station to see how well that would actually work in space. So you can kind of launch it in a smaller compact size and then inflate it up to a much larger internal volume once it's up on the space station. I think those are going to be very useful for more deep space missions.
That's fascinating.
Michael, where are we speaking to you from this morning? Are you at SpaceX, and is that where you, I would imagine, like most of us, you're working remotely a lot from your, your living room, but do you report each day normally to SpaceX?
Yeah, before the pandemic, I was at SpaceX every day in Southern California. Right now I'm in Park City vacationing.
Well, how about that? I could have had you come into the studio with your mask.
Yeah, I suppose so. But now that the pandemic has hit, we've tried to take as many precautions as possible. So I'll go into SpaceX a couple of times a week to check on the hardware status. And then as missions are coming up, we have what we call simulations of the mission in the mission control room to simulate either the ascent or the landing, different phases of the mission. And some sim supervisor will inject failures into the simulation, and you want to make sure that the operations team knows how to handle those situations. So I'll go in for a lot of those, and then the actual missions, whether it's the launch or the landing. Once it's docked to the space station, it's pretty quiescent, and we kind of go down to a skeleton crew.
Right.
So what's been interesting with the pandemic is everybody has been sort of working less, but with the Demo 2 mission, it feels like I've been working more. We've been doing telecons for years, since we have parts of the program in Florida, parts of the program in Houston, parts of the program in Alabama, and as well as in California. So we've been doing WebEx telecons for years and years since the start of the program. And that ramped up dramatically, as you would imagine, leading up to a launch and the first test flight with the humans on board. And it's actually been more busy than not. But I've been doing those telecons from home, as you mentioned.
Right. So I know that we're looking forward to the Crew One mission in October, but it was so exciting watching Bob and Doug, as in Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley, when they launched from the Demo 2, the test flight, which launched the end of May. I think maybe because of the pandemic and because many of us were just at home looking for something to watch, I feel like so many more people than would typically watch a launch watch that launch. And for the full, 4 or 5 hours that there was coverage of it, it was so exciting. And then they splashed down off the coast of I'm not sure where they splashed down. It was in the Gulf of Mexico, actually. Okay,
yeah.
Great. And they got back safe. Can you just give us a little wrap on that? And is the reason that they didn't stay longer because essentially it was a demo flight test?
Correct. It was a test flight. So originally it was only going to be about 10 days to meet the basic objectives of the test flight. But as we've worked with the needs of the space station program, they needed additional manpower on board space station to help do those EVAs and change out those batteries. So as the program worked through the details, they decided about a 2-month stay was going to be sufficient to do all the work that they needed on board the space station with that additional manpower. And then we tried to get them back as soon as possible, because actually this Demo 2 capsule, we're hoping to refurbish and fly it as the Crew 2 capsule. So similar to the space shuttle, where it would fly and then come back and get refurbished and fly again, we're getting ready to reuse this this Demo 2 capsule. So as we're tearing it down to do the inspections and understand how well it performed, they're getting ready to put it back together again to fly as the Crew 2 vehicle. And just as a point of reference, the vehicle for the Crew 1 mission has already shipped from California out to Florida and is in its final integration phases, getting ready for that October launch.
It sure is going to get crowded up there. Lynn, I don't know if you've looked at some of the scheduling, but tentatively they're going to be with Crew 1 going up no earlier than October 23rd. But the Russians are lifting off a Soyuz a couple of weeks ahead of time in mid-October. So they're going to be a crew of Russians up there. There's going to be the current crew that's up there that will be all together for a few days. And then by the time we get up there in late October, some of them will leave and some more will come. I mean, it's getting kind of crowded up there, isn't it?
Yeah, I think at times it can get crowded. Obviously, when the space shuttle came up with potentially 7 people, it would get really crowded on board the space station. But the space station was designed to handle a crew of 7 on a steady state basis. So that's sort of why the commercial crew vehicles, both the SpaceX and the Boeing vehicles, are designed to fly 4 people. And then obviously the Russian Soyuz is designed to fly 3 people. So you get that total crew.
Now, Michael, you work for NASA and you are managing the SpaceX commercial crew program, but there is another partner, and that, of course, is Boeing. And Demo 2 was SpaceX, and Crew 1 is SpaceX. How are things going? I know you're not responsible for Boeing, but how are things going with the other partner, Boeing? Are they going to get into this at some point?
Yeah. Just to clarify, I'm the manager at SpaceX, not the overall program manager.
Crew program. Yeah.
I was the manager for the initial cargo vehicle development program, but not for the crew program. Boeing is moving along. They had an orbital, what they called an orbital test flight that was supposed to go up unmanned and dock to the space station. Unfortunately, there were some problems with that mission, and it did not make it all the way to the space station. And they've elected to do another unmanned mission, which I think is planned for the end of the year. So they're going to fix those problems that they found during that unmanned test flight and then do another unmanned test flight to be ready to before they start flying crew. And then there's planned a crewed test flight early next year, I think, is the rough schedule.
Well, it certainly is exciting to, in the space of, you know, one summer, essentially, from May, watching the first launch of the Demo 2, and then October 23rd, again, Crew 1 will launch. And what an exciting time for you. It's an exciting time for our country. It's an exciting time for those who love, and those of us who are sort of newly turned on by space travel and watching it. I'm one of those people. John has been enthusiastic about space travel since he was a wee little boy. And so we're so happy you could join us again. Michael Horkachuk, vacationing here in Park City. Next time we'll have you into the studio, Michael. Thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.